This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine, plus global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. This week, it is all about the year ahead issue, the major trends, disruptions, breakthrough products, innovations, and movements to watch out for this year.
That's right. Everything from EV fever and Tesla's test
to fake meats, FDA nod, flying taxis, wellness eating, and the big bet on global golf.
It's all in the new issue. And over the next couple of hours, we're going to touch on some of it, including the issue's annual collaboration with our Bloomberg Intelligence team on the 50 companies to watch. They narrow it down from 2000, Carol. This is one of, I know it's one of your favorite sections. You say it, but this is the second year I've gotten to see it, at least as part of Bloomberg.
Yeah.
It's also one of my favorites.
It's names you'll know and some names you will not, but it's a global overview of companies to keep an eye on. We'll even find some time to talk about how wine will change in 2022.
Are we still going to get to drink it? Are you still going to get to drink it?
Maybe.
Hopefully it doesn't change too much, okay?
Yeah, exactly. Well, all that to come. We're going to kick it off, though, with the editor of Bloomberg Business Week, Joel Weber.
Carol, you caught up with Joel for an overview of the year ahead issue.
Well, we really try and think about what the big themes are. And obviously, there's going to be some things that over the course of the year just crop up. And those will just be the things that, you know, we will cover as news. But really, you have to kind of think about where the money is flowing. Like, for instance, electric vehicles. We've seen just a huge acceleration in adoption and companies tacking that way. And yet there's still this massive category, probably the biggest category of all, that is totally up for grabs, and that's electric vehicle trucks, right?
Right.
So looking at how that truck landscape is going to play out, that will be a story. Obviously, it's in the issue, but we just know that it's going to be a line of reporting throughout the year. And similarly, you know, here we are we've had tons of companies go public via things like SPACs. You know, flying taxis is this whole space
that
you can almost laugh at, and yet there was serious money that poured in there. And now we're going to see how those companies fare on the public market.
Well, speaking of a lot of serious money going into a certain area, fintech, and you guys in the magazine, you know, are constantly talking about the intersection of finance and technology. We're seeing a lot of disruption in payment systems and in the ways consumers gain access to credit. Hannah Levin has a great piece in the finance section in this week's issue. Why is 2022 such an important year for fintech?
Well, we've just seen how easy it is to basically, like, you know, take your business model, put it on an app, and make it hyper, hyper easy to use. And, you know, Robinhood really embodies that. But there's going to be, you know, there's new players that are going to get into that space, and there's just new ways that consumers are interacting with commerce. And, like, one of the stories in the section that I just love is about the buy now, pay later piece.
Mm-hmm.
And we think this is going to be, and when you think about the companies that are in this, the Afterpays, the Klarnas, like, you know, you can basically look at them, see the growth that they've had. And then in the story, they basically say this is the year that you will see it in brick and mortar retail, which I think is, like, astounding. It's like you basically could go check out at, like, a Best Buy or something. And instead of using, you know, a debit card or a credit card, it's like, what if you could actually say, I want to buy this now, but actually pay later. And they say that is the next big wave that we will see this year. But then on the consumer side, you know, there's still a risk there. And we know that regulators are taking an interest in this, because while it might not ding your credit history, your credit scores initially, if you default on those payments, you're still going to have, you know, potentially people coming after you for money. So we're gonna see how much consumers are willing to adopt this model instead of credit cards.
Well, and I feel like every time I buy something, I see a buy now, pay later button. They're just popping up all over.
Get ready for more.
Okay, I'm ready. Well, you mentioned it's caught the attention of regulators, all the changes that are going on in fintech. It's also caught the attention of big banks. They've got to be, like, wondering, okay, are we going to lose, you know, our supreme spot at the top?
Yeah, and that's why they're so busy in Washington, D.C., right? And they have, you know, long history in D.C., but you know, those relationships will remain really important, and why, you know, lobbying dollars will remain ever high. And, you know, as long as we're talking about D.C., let's just also talk about, this is going to be a year of midterms, and I think that we spent a lot of time in the issue talking about that, and obviously in America that will become a huge theme as the year progresses.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, you do get into that in the technology section. You know, we know that things like social media has played a really big role in politics already. What are we anticipating for 2022? I mean, leading to more division? What does it mean for how the social media companies regulate all of this or oversee all of this? What are we expecting?
Well, we know how crucial it's been. The country is incredibly divisive right now. We will anticipate, you know, all of the social platforms having to come out, and they've been kind of quiet so far, as the story explains. So we're waiting to see what they're going to do in terms of moderation and in terms of censorship. There's a number of noteworthy politicians who have been banned. Is there a version where even, you know, with Dorsey at Twitter moving aside, like, will Twitter reassess? And if Trump comes back onto a platform, like, obviously that would be a huge shift in where things currently stand. So there's a lot of unknowns, but as we get closer to midterms, some of these things are going to be talked about again and again. The other favorite election story in here is that obviously Georgia was just a huge state last time around, and if you can believe it, it's only going to be a stranger, weirder election there because there's so many elections. We've got Senate seats, we've got governor races. It's just going to all eyes on Georgia again.
That was Bloomberg Businessweek editor Joel Weber. The new issue on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Don't go anywhere. More to come from the year ahead issue, including companies from Airbnb to Lululemon, the 50 stocks to keep an eye on in 2022. Our Bloomberg intelligence team has done the research, and we will reveal why these firms should be on your radar.
You're listening to Bloomberg Businessweek. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
This week, it's the year-ahead issue of Bloomberg Business Week, and a favorite part, the 50 companies to watch compiled with our Bloomberg intelligence team.
Putting it together, Rebecca Penty, Solutions and Strategy Senior Editor at Bloomberg Business Week. She joined us, along with Business Week Editor Joel Weber.
The way that this whole project starts is they take this massive universe of companies that they cover, more than 2,000, and basically start running it through their spreadsheets. And it's just like this gigantic filtering effect to come up with these 50. And really excited about them because they're not hard calls. They're not, you know, buy and sell recommendations. That's not what we're going to get from Bloomberg Intelligence. I think it's more interesting and perhaps nuanced than that because we think of them as just companies to watch. Some of them have positive sentiment, some of them have negative sentiment, but they're just ones that we think in the year ahead are going to be really, really, really interesting companies.
Yeah, so Rebecca, come on in here and talk a little bit about some of these companies here. I mean, the one that jumped out at me was Airbnb, because I feel like I've been watching Airbnb for years at this point after its huge IPO and the way the company was able to recover during the pandemic after laying off so many people. How did Airbnb make the cut?
Yeah, I think Airbnb will be quite familiar to a lot of us who wanted to travel during the pandemic but didn't feel safe at a hotel, for example. So bookings have been up, and interestingly, they've done really, really well with long stays, so people staying for kind of weeks on end. Now, the Bloomberg Intelligence analysts feel like Airbnb sets itself apart from rivals with its brand advantage. So it's very recognizable, and it doesn't even really need to spend that much in marketing. So that's where Bloomberg Intelligence says investors should be watching this company.
Okay, so another one that I love, and by the way, can we just all say when it's like whatever the weather was it 19? It feels like it's like single digits. Like I'm ready for travel, and Airbnb is definitely on
warm.
That list. So there's also, you know, New Year's resolutions, Lululemon, another one that's on the list, they're bigger than just athleisure wear now, right, Rebecca? Like their acquisition of Mirror has sort of changed what the company kind of looks like. Talk to us more about why Lululemon's on the list.
Yeah, definitely. And I think the idea of working out at home might have seemed like a niche thing before the pandemic. You know, not everyone has an in-home gym, but Lululemon's acquisition of Mirror actually was quite well timed. This is the at-home gym where you can see your workout in the mirror. So like Peloton, they've done really well with that. Lululemon also has in-store events that they've been doing. So really, I guess the point is they're more than just yoga pants, and that's reflected in the positive outlook.
I got to say, I'm waiting for somebody to be like, Master, do you have anything else but yoga pants? I mean, I know it's more than yoga pants, but yoga pants and a top. That feels like work wear. Hey, First Solar is also on that list. It's been around for a while. Why is this one all of a sudden popping up on the list, Rebecca?
Yeah, I think one of the things that might be surprising to people who don't follow the solar industry super closely is that it's no longer super expensive. You know, it had this reputation of being, you know, a space that was just never going to get mainstream. But actually, solar is the most cost-competitive supply source for electric power now, and First Solar is the largest U.S. solar panel maker. They're investing at home and abroad, and they've just won a major order from the oil major BP and Lightstream BP, which is a renewables company that BP has a share in. So they're definitely one to watch.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the Asia-Pacific region and see. It's Southeast Asia's biggest gaming and e-commerce company. I think people who, I don't know, might have been following some growth names in the last couple of years would know C, because in 2020 it was up nearly 400%, but it did not perform that well in 2021, only up 12%. Why is it on the list for 2022?
Yeah, so the thing with these mobile gaming companies like C is that they've got this huge number of players. C's got 700 million active players for its Free Fire game. And now it's branching into all sorts of new services, including online grocery delivery and fintech. And so the Bloomberg Intelligence analysts are saying, look, they've got 700 million active players of Free Fire that they can cross-market their new services to. So that's a huge bonus for them.
If we're going through regions, we've hit U.S., we've hit Asia. Let's bring it around to EMEA. What's a company with positive sentiment in Europe that we like, Rebecca?
Well, it might be kind of surprising that the Bloomberg Intelligence analysts have picked a tour operator when so many things are still shut down. They've picked TUI. So they are a European tour operator that BI thinks is poised to benefit from a return to travel. And you know, we all remember Thomas Cook's failure during the pandemic. Investors are a little cautious on TUI because they just want to make sure that it's not going to follow in Thomas Cook's footsteps. But the tour operator's got a restructuring going on. It's upgrading its technology, and it's really changing the way it operates to focus on offering travelers flexibility and access to premium resorts. So that's definitely one to look at as people start to emerge from, you know, lockdowns and go see the site.
All right, Rebecca, Robinhood. Man, we talked about it a lot last year. What do we need to be thinking about with this one? Because it made the list.
Yeah, so Robinhood is one that we've thought about a lot during the meme stock frenzies in early 2021. But now they're, you know, under the thumb of regulators, including potentially the Securities and Exchange Commission, and there's a big lawsuit in Massachusetts that could help decide their fate and whether they have to impose stricter investor protection rules. So if they lose, that's going to be a big negative for Robinhood. And if they win, well, let's see.
That was Rebecca Penty, Solutions and Strategy Senior Editor at Bloomberg Businessweek, who joined us along with Businessweek Editor Joel Weber. Be sure to check out all 50 companies. You can find the story in the magazine, on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com/businessweek, and on the Bloomberg Terminal. Well, still to come on Bloomberg Businessweek, more from the year-ahead issue, including a special report on flying taxis.
You ready?
Yeah, I don't know. I was looking at this, Carol, and it's like, they say they're supposed to be quieter, but I don't know where our listeners are all over, of course. But if you live in a city, you've come to understand like the thud, 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 thud of helicopters a lot.
And but they're not just tricked out helicopters, right? We're talking like little jets,
yeah,
right?
I'll believe it when I see it, okay?
You ready to pay
for
it?
Do that quietly.
You ready to pay for it?
Yeah, no, definitely not. Are you?
Probably not.
I sound like such a sourpuss, right?
But there is one that's out there to make it kind of, you know, access to a broader group of people.
Yeah.
So we'll see about that. That's coming up next. This is Bloomberg.
broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
In this week's The Year Ahead issue, a special section devoted to electric vertical takeoff and landing aircraft, better known perhaps as flying taxis. Are we moving from hype to actually hopping in one? Ready, Tim?
No, not yet, but maybe soon. Well, for more on that and a look at the leading players and where they stand and I guess where they fly and whether infrastructure is actually up to snuff to handle these things. I mean, look, we can't even get an infrastructure deal passed, right?
Yeah. Okay. Check out the bridges around here.
Yeah, exactly. Let's check in with Bloomberg czar of hyperdrive, aka senior editor with our Bloomberg Green team, Dimitra Kasanidis. Dimitra, why should we be paying attention to eVTOL companies this year?
Well, we should be paying attention to them because they're coming, and there have been big investments, notably by and big orders by major commercial airlines. So for a while, we were thinking, okay, these are being built, and people are pouring money into them, but how are they going to be used, and are they really going to become part of the kind of airspace infrastructure wherever we're talking about? And it's looking now like more and more, there's a lot of interest in how these can be utilized also by airlines to get people to airports and in many other ways. So I think that's why we should be paying attention to it, because it's moving ahead, the technology is developed, they're trying to plan for the infrastructure, and they're really coming. Mm-hmm. And they might, in fact, make travel a lot easier.
Well, what's interesting, too, and what jumped out in this coverage is the amount of major airlines, you know, your Uniteds, your all the big carriers, they're lining up to be involved in this, and they're even, in some cases, backing it.
Yeah, indeed. And that is, you know, that started to really take hold in 2021. By the end of the summer into the fall, what we noticed were there were pretty big orders by many of the major carriers. We focus in on the lead story on Virgin, for example, and their order and their work with a company called Vertical. And, you know, there's a lot that's going on with the airline industry right now. And I think that this is one piece of them looking for ways to figure out how to bring in other revenue streams and how to up for some of what's been going on and how to make the travel experience possibly something that, you know, is better for travelers,
right.
But also again, that they can attach some kind of a premium cost to. Hey. If they set up a pickup point and they can get you to the airport faster with the company that they've signed up with, you know, they're very interested in that.
So Dimitra, it's not just a case of FOMO, right? Like the carriers are just lining up because they don't want to maybe miss out. They actually see a practical use here.
I think that is true. There, you know, there's still a question of a bit of FOMO, but at the numbers of orders that we're seeing and for what this will cost, and again, the commitment that you're going to need to make, you know, I think it definitely goes beyond FOMO. And for now, it really does appear to be an avenue that they believe will be worthwhile for them and will enhance the travel experience for their customers.
Hey, what is the actual experience for people who are not in one of these vehicles? And I'm wondering, because of the sound that is associated with helicopters right now, I know these are electric. Some even have, you know, instead of rotors, have actual jet engines. But are they loud like helicopters because of the displacement of air?
Look, a lot of this is what they tell us these are.
Because we haven't seen these, right? It's a good point.
One of the reasons we wonder how this is all going to work is we don't actually have, I mean, there have been test flights and there certainly have been ways in which, you know, you do have an experience and you see it. They are quieter, you know, they're safer. Given the technology that's involved. Eventually, as crazy as this sounds, the goal for these is to, now we're talking way into the future, for these to be autonomous, not just electric, and for these to be pilotless. That is a very, very long-term goal. I mean, right now we talk in the section about the challenges of regulatory approvals for these types of aircraft,
right.
And we're talking about it in the context of these operating with pilots. So it'll become even that much harder when you're putting together a proposition of pilotless. but they're more efficient because they're electric. They are quieter because they're electric. They're safer, and that's all part of the experience.
A big thank you to Bloomberg's czar of hyperdrive, also known as senior editor with our Bloomberg Green team, Demetra Kasanidis. Still to come, we're going to continue with this week's The Year Ahead issue, what we all as consumers might expect in 2022, including big releases from Hollywood on the actual big screen back in theaters we're talking about, to EV fever from electric trucks.
Plus, Biogen's Alzheimer's drug in the hot seat, the fur industry's last gasp, consumer trends to come. That is next. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We are all in on 2022. So too is this week's Bloomberg Business Week with its annual The Year Ahead issue, including a deep dive into how we consume things, Tim.
So back to movie theaters?
Maybe.
Jumping into electric trucks? I think. Yeah, for a lot of people and a lot of companies, certainly. What about wearing fur, Carol?
I don't see it on you.
Yeah, no, not for me. But hey, something for everyone in this section of the issue.
Absolutely. Covers a lot of ground. Bloomberg Business Week Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis is here with the rundown. Jim, we talked a lot about EVs in 2021. Now, battery-powered trucks are in the spotlight. So what do we need to be watching out for?
I mean, it's going to be a real battle between the large established truck makers like GM and Ford and Tesla. I mean, what happened when the car business was that the main companies set back, especially the U.S. companies, just sort of set back and let Tesla basically build this market. And one reason was not that they didn't have an interest in it, but simply that the car business in the U.S. doesn't make a lot of money. The truck business is where they make all their money. And so, therefore, they didn't seem to worry about, Elon Musk making himself into the world's richest man until it actually hit them, which is that Tesla is going to bring out the Cybertruck, and that is going to be something that goes straight at the heart of the profits of GM and Ford. And so, therefore, they have gotten serious about electric trucks, and that's going to be the real battleground this year.
Yeah, I mean, and Ford's actually off to a pretty good start. 200,000 customers roughly have put down $100 to reserve the electric F-150 Lightning pickup. That thing's pretty cool, and it's actually not that expensive, Jim. Does Ford have what it takes to kind of beat Tesla at its own game? Or maybe it's not even a fair question because kind of, you know, trucks are GM and Ford's game, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you've raised the right question, which is, when it comes to trucks, you know, Ford is the truck leader. The F-150 is the most popular vehicle in the U.S., car or truck. I mean, and so it is, it's their business to lose. Likewise, the Silverado, which is always vying with the F-150, is the big, truck in the U.S. But the difference is that this is a market that hasn't been around before, this whole notion of a truck that is not gasoline powered. And so that makes it difficult to know whether the consumer loyalty that was built up over years in, GM and Ford's trucks is going to run over into the EV world. I mean, one of the reasons that the pricing of these trucks is so important is that Detroit for a long time thought that electric trucks were going to be so expensive and not able to actually do the hauling and towing that trucks were expected to, that they sort of thought, we got a lot of time. But what's happened is battery prices have come way down over the last few years, and the public imagination has been sort of sparked by electric cars. And so all of a sudden, a lot of people, particularly construction firms and commercial vehicles, have started to think, well, maybe an EV truck will work for me as well. That has sort of pushed the American automakers to start saying, well, we don't have to just do fancy $100,000 EV trucks like the Hummer. Instead, what we're going to do is jump in around the $40,000 mark and try to do work truck versions that our existing base of truck owners can sort of segue into. That's going to be it's going to be a test to see if people will prefer to go to the Cybertruck because it's new and it's sexy, it's a hot company, or do they want to stick with brands that they know?
Jim, in the meantime, we've seen the entertainment industry focus largely on streaming during the pandemic. Now Hollywood is heading back to theaters. Is in-person cinema,
Is it really heading back?
I'm so skeptical of this because it's like each time we think that we're going to go, you know, back to some sort of return to 2019, there's some sort of new variant. And with consumers getting so used to watching this stuff from their couch, are we really going to go back to theaters?
Well, that is the big test for the industry in 2022. However, they want to test it. I mean, they are aggressively starting to put movies back into theatrical release, as opposed to last year when a lot of things were released simultaneously theatrically and on streaming or introduced on streaming. That, however, is not the greatest financial model. It turned out that you get less revenue that way, surprise, and you don't build a lot of sort of excitement about a film that will lead you to have an installed base of viewers who want to see it the next time out if you want to build a franchise.
Right.
So therefore, they really want to get out there and get people back into the theater seats. Obviously, theater owners also want to get people back out because they make their money not from ticket sales, but from all that popcorn and soda that we, sort of consume while we're there.
Oh, come on. Who eats it? Who eats when they're at a movie theater?
The margins on popcorn are pretty good.
Oh, come on. Now, because families that go to a movie, and that's one of the issues here. Families that go to films spend huge amounts of money. Average about, if you take a family of four, the average now in a Cineplex is about approaching $90 to take them out. So there's actually a lot of money to be made in the concessions business, but you can't have concession sales if you don't have people coming out to theaters,
right.
And people don't want to come out to theaters because of COVID, so you have to come up with some sort of great event thing to make them come out.
Is that a sign that, listen, you give us a good film, we're going to go see it on the big screen?
Right, and they didn't think that would work, and instead, the Spider-Man No Way Home has made already $1.3 billion in theaters only. And it didn't open until mid-December. And so, it was just in the last 2 weeks of last year, it was the biggest movie of the year. It only ran 2 weeks in that year. I mean, so it's suddenly, there's something going on. So lots and lots of producers and studios and talent are suddenly saying, my God, people do want to go out. And we just have to give them a reason to do that. And so we're going to see more of the big name sort of attempts, to get back out there.
Hey, I want to get to another story that you guys cover in this section in the Year Ahead issue, Jim. And that has to do with a drug from Biogen, the first new Alzheimer's treatment in almost 20 years. We got some news this week that wasn't necessarily so good for them. What's important about this one? I mean, it seems like it's a big one. Alzheimer's has been, I feel like, one of those diseases, ailments that it's just been hard to find a really good treatment for.
Right. I mean, it is, it affects, I guess, just
so
in the
many.
U.S. alone, about 6 million people, and there's no great treatment for it. And people have been really excited over this drug from Biogen called Aduhelm because it looked to show some promise. Or it's an extremely controversial drug. Bunch of doctors on an FDA advisory committee were concerned that it really wasn't that effective and that it didn't really slow the progression of Alzheimer's. And so when the FDA approved this drug last summer, a bunch of the advisors resigned. And so that has put it on the in the news as being controversial. And it didn't get a lot of sales right off. It was extremely expensive. So it was over $50,000 a year. It's also difficult to administer because it's not a pill. It's not just a shot, but it's a series of monthly intravenous infusions. And even with that, it still seemed to have less efficacy than maybe even a third. So a lot of doctors are saying, is this really helpful treatment? And a lot of insurers are saying, why should we spend the money? And so finally, the latest sort of strike against it came this week when Medicare, big health coverage system for 63 million elderly, suddenly said, well, we think that right now it ought to only be reimbursed for people who are in clinical trials, which is a big sign that they are questioning the efficacy of this drug and they want to see it proven. And that's important because Medicare is the biggest potential payer for this, And Medicare has already said that it's going to make a final decision on whether to cover it by April. But if it's now coming out and saying, well, we think we ought to only, you know, look at the people who are in test programs right now, that doesn't bode well for Biogen.
That's Bloomberg Businessweek Assistant Managing Editor Jim Ellis. And that wraps up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Businessweek from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Messer. Are you sure you're not going to wear fur?
I could be convinced. I actually do have a jacket with fur on it.
I know. I hate to say
I do.
What?
I don't know. I mean, I didn't kind of realize it was real fur until after I bought it, but Carol, it's cozy.
It's warm.
Am I going to get in trouble for saying that?
Well, what's interesting in the article, too, is that, you know, as we move towards sustainability and clothing, like you think about something that is made, forgive me, I'm not pro or con, but something that can be passed down because it lasts, whether it's fur or, you know, even leather. Like these things last. I know.
That animal didn't last.
I know. And that's why like this whole idea, it's tricky. And you've got folks like Gucci and YSL saying, we're not going to use fur anymore.
Right.
So they're moving on. All right. As we mentioned, that does wrap up the first hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. I'm Carol Messer.
And I'm Tim Stenovic. Coming up in our next hour, the biggest danger to the global economy this year, guess what? It's not the pandemic.
Wait, what?
Yeah, exactly.
Plus, a go-to voice throughout the pandemic for us. We're talking about Alan Patricoff of Greycroft. He's looking at the coming year of venture capital investing and more.
And non-alcoholic wines. Yeah, you heard me right. Wines without
Why
alcohol.
Why bother?
Well, beer without alcohol has grown in popularity
I
do like it over the last couple of years. So the question is, can they do the same thing with wine? Also, the off-road culture that's bringing luxury to the woods by car.
I'm in on that. All right, more from the Year Ahead issue that's coming up. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine. Plus, global business, finance, and tech news as it happens. Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Hi, I'm Carol Messer.
And I'm Tim Stenovic.
Plenty ahead in our second hour of the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week. The issue this week, it is all about the year ahead, including this year's biggest worries when it comes to the global economy.
And on a lighter note, the pursuit of some finer things, from off-roading and style to wine sticker shocks, and really, knowing what you eat.
Yeah, we're getting down into the microorganisms on that one. We also have some thoughts on the startup space for this year as well, from a well-known name in VC who has been investing for half a century. We're talking about Alan Patricoff.
First up this hour, the year ahead cover story. The biggest dangers to the economy this year. It might be a surprise to a lot of you. It relates to a couple of this week's big events. Monetary policy, which we heard a lot about again this week in the U.S. from Fed Chief Jay Powell and other members of the Fed, along with an inflation print in the U.S. that hit a 39-year high.
All of that was front and center this week. For more, let's bring in our senior executive editor for economics at Bloomberg, head of Bloomberg Economics, Stephanie Flanders. She writes about things like inflation, monetary policy, and getting the global economy wrong. That will be indeed on everyone's minds. Stephanie joining us from London. So, Stephanie, central bankers under the microscope, perhaps even more this year. Tell us why.
Well, it's because we're really going to find out this year whether the economy has changed in a sort of lasting way as a result of COVID, or is actually just going through a phase, the supply chain issues, the inflation, all the things that the strange things we're seeing in the labor market where people, you know, you can't find people to work for you, even though there seem to be plenty of people not working. And all of those things, economists are kind of assuming, and indeed the Federal Reserve is kind of assuming, that by the end of this year, that will all have gone away and that we will be more or less back on track to a sort of normal economy. And they're assuming they won't necessarily have to do that much to stop inflation, and they won't have to worry that much about labor shortages in a few months' time. But what if they're wrong? What if they just call the post-COVID recovery wrong? And that's something I go through in my year ahead piece. You know, would they end up doing too much to combat inflation or too little? Mm-hmm. You can't help thinking they're likely to get it. It's such a difficult riding this balance this year is so hard. I can't help thinking they're going to mess up one way or the other.
But it's like, where's the playbook on this, right? Where's the playbook?
right.
Well, and Stephanie,
people are going back to the 70s, saying, you know, are we now in a world where we should worry more about negative hits to supply coming from maybe the oil sector and increases in inflation, or are we still more or less in that low interest rate, low inflation world where there's, you know, mostly prices are, you know, falling more than they're rising?
Right.
We've been in for 10 or 20 years.
Stephanie, what I love about this, it's obviously taking a global perspective, right? Because we've seen supply chain disruptions because of COVID. It's a global phenomenon. At the same time, you point out in your remarks that the U.S., I mean, generates approximately 1/4 of world output. How important is what the U.S. does in terms of impacting the global economic and market outlook?
You know, I think that's another thing we're going to find out. Obviously, the U.S. has been the sort of the big player for decades, really setting the tone for the global economy, maybe even more than you would have expected the last 10 or 20 years, because by and large, the U.S. has done better than most countries. So a lot of the investment has flowed there. Certainly the stock market in the U.S. has done a lot better than any other stock market in the world. But, you know, you have China now punching at least at its weight, going its own way in monetary policy this year for the first time. You've got the Central Bank of China is actually going to be cutting interest rates as the Federal Reserve is raising them. We've never had that before. We've always had the China having to follow anything the Fed did. So that's an interesting moment. That do we start to have a different sphere of activity in China and around China? And are they setting the tone for global growth just as much as the U.S.? We'll find that out a bit. But, of course, large parts of the world, particularly emerging market economies, are going to be looking at every step in the way that the Fed takes, because we know from history that when the Federal Reserve starts raising interest rates, actually the people who often feel the pain are not in the U.S. They're the countries at the sharp end who are already vulnerable, right. You know, whether it's Argentina, Brazil, Turkey this time, I think.
Those emerging market economies. What's interesting, and I know your team has covered this a lot, I think it's an important factor, the diversion or the separation of what the Fed does versus the People's Bank of China. And you point out in your column, you know, for the first time in living memory, China's going to be moving in exactly the opposite direction from the Fed. I do wonder what that means if the U.S. is doing raising rates, China isn't, you know, there'll be cheap money still around there in different parts of the world, what that means in terms of economic growth and really, you know, financial markets, who benefits, who doesn't.
Yeah, and so that's one of the things, you know, that certainly investors have usually said, you know, this is the stage in the cycle where you might expect the rest of the world to sort of catch up a bit of the ground that they lost. You know, the U.S. starts slowing down, and so the opportunities are in the other parts of the world, which are still a bit sort of earlier in their cycle. I think that could possibly happen in Europe, because the European Central Bank's still going to have interest rates super, super low. It's not going to be raising them this year unless something very surprising happens. They have trouble generating any inflation. They've not got much even now. So I think there's that sort of pulling down interest rates, that global impact. And yeah, you're right. As I said, you know, China's going to be plotting its own path. I guess we have to remember, though, that the reason that China's doing that is that they've already had a slowdown in their economy.
Right.
And they're trying to kind of maintain growth. We're going to have slower growth in China in this year and last year than we've seen in decades of its very rapid development. And that could be destabilizing for that region. If you think of all the people who've been building their own wealth and their own economic growth on feeding that amazing Chinese sort of engine, that economy, if it's slowing down, that could have an impact, unexpected impact on people around the world.
Thank you so much, Stephanie Flanders, who heads up the Bloomberg Economics team, also senior executive editor for economics at Bloomberg. Thanks, Stephanie.
Coming up, he's been investing in the venture capital space for 50 years and counting. We'll hear what is on his radar this year. We're talking about Alan Patricoff.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week. This is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
We love our guests and those that come on to chat with us, no doubt about it, and some of them especially so for their ability and willingness to go to a lot of places with us from an informed vantage point. We talk politics, economics, investing, so much more.
And one of those individuals is Alan Patricoff, an early venture capitalist who helped build and grow such companies as, oh, you might have heard of these, Carol, America Online, Office Depot, this computer company that was once called Apple Computer, also Audible. He's got a great sense of trends to watch thanks to his experience as a venture capitalist for, wow, half a century.
It's a long, long time. Alan Patricoff is Chairman Emeritus, co-founder of Graycroft. He's co-founder of Primetime Partners. We talked about a lot of things. Here's some of our conversation.
Well, we're starting off, coming off a period of euphoria as we ended 2021. And I don't see that diminishing, certainly in the near term. There's a lot of money washing around in the institutional market in particular, and venture performance has been exceptional in the past 12 to 24 months. So everybody is feeling quite euphoric, and I don't see anything that's going to change that other than a surprise. And I've been in this investment business long enough to know that surprises, which are what they are called, a surprise, is the one thing that kind of shakes everybody. Venture is not affected by interest rates. It really isn't affected by inflation, because all these companies are we invested are so early on that they kind of can override that with their growth trends.
So where are you seeing areas of interest for 2022, and where are you seeing areas of focus, at least for venture capital funding? If it is going to be another big year for venture, if it is going to be another big year for investments and returns, where is that going to happen specifically?
Well, selfishly, you know, I started in the last 18 months a new firm called Primetime Partners,
right,
which is focused on an area that virtually was a white space, which is anything that serves the ageless, what I call the ageless community, which is enormous and getting bigger and will be the largest part of the population by 2030, growing faster with more money, and the older generation is living longer. And there are so many things that they need specifically in terms of products, services, technologies, experiences. And it's not the same as the millennial generation, where most of the focus in venture has been. But I see that as an increasing trend. We kind of had a little bit of it to ourselves in the beginning, but I can see already that others are encroaching on the area. And they're not names you would recognize, because they're all relatively early. But I think over the next year or two, you're going to hear names like a place called Mom, which is the one perhaps that's known. But it's an increasing trend. So that's my focus on Primetime. In terms of Graycroft, we continue to be interested in fintech. There's been a lot of interest in every form of new kind of neo-banking. Any place that people can buy money, we have a company called Public, which is, I hate to compare it, but similar to Robinhood in the sense that you can buy in very small fractional interests. And payment systems are increasing all the time. We have a company that's dealing in Africa called Flutterwave, which seems to have no end. It's like the Square of Africa, and growth has been enormous. So fintech is a big area of investment.
You mentioned earlier for our global audience about how there's a lot of money sloshing around. That money sloshing around can go into some really great, interesting places. Is there any concern that some of that money is going to go into places that is bidding up areas that are going to make no sense in years to come? And I don't know whether it could be crypto, NFTs, SPACs. Just curious what you think.
You're bringing up the controversy that always exists, is whether there's too much money chasing too few deals. Mm-hmm. I think that we have a lot of large size funds, without naming anyone in particular, but which are hedge funds, or large growth funds. When you see funds that are being raised at $10 and $20 billion and trying to put money to work in the later stages of growth companies, inevitably you're seeing a bigger demand than just a limited supply of companies that can absorb that kind of capital. So they're going to be excesses. I don't think you could translate that specifically to crypto, to NFTs, which are, you know, each one has its own area of focus. The NFTs is the latest on the horizon, and I think there's a lot of interest, and I think it will sort itself over time.
Hey, Alan, I hope we've got a few minutes left here, and I'd love to ask you a little bit about, you've got a book coming out in May, No Red Lights, Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital and Never Driving Alone. Looking forward to it, and I hope when it comes out, you'll come on and talk to us about it. Tell us about why you wanted to write a book.
It's nice of you to ask. Actually, this is the first time anything about the book has actually been on the air in any form. So this is the first time, because it was just released on Amazon for pre-order this week.
Yeah.
You know, I've been asked for many years to write down things that have happened in my life. And because I've, you know, being around in the business 50 years, actually, I've been in the investment business 65 years, but being in the venture capital business 50 years, you become a legend just by living long enough, nothing more than that. And so I am a living legend. I used to be the founder of the venture industry, then I was the father of it, then I became the grandfather of it, now I'm a legend. I don't know what the next stage I'll be the former. I spent the last year or two writing this, and I hope it'll be of interest to some people. It's really designed to, honestly, the real reason is I am 87. Mm. I just hired a track coach to try to walk, run the marathon next November.
Wow.
And good for you.
I live a very active life, as you mm-hmm. announced my two affiliations. And I want to be an inspiration to people and say, if I can do it, I keep going at this stage, why can't you?
That's Alan Patrickoff, Chairman Emeritus and co-founder of Greycroft, co-founder of Primetime Partners as well. His new book coming out this year, it's called No Red Lights, Reflections on Life, 50 Years in Venture Capital, and Never Driving Alone. It's due out in the spring.
I'm so glad we got to talk to him about it a little bit, and I can't wait to actually get into it with him once it's published.
And, you know, we kind of got the exclusive, right?
He really did.
He hadn't talked about the book at all yet.
That was, I think,
publicly. It was pretty cool.
I think that was my favorite part of that conversation. All right, still to come, Intel is about to relinquish its chip-making crown to Samsung.
It's a symbolic blow for the U.S. at a time when the geopolitics of semiconductors are trickier than ever. This is Bloomberg.
Broadcasting from the financial capital of the world, Bloomberg 1130 in New York, to Washington, D.C., Bloomberg 991, to Boston, Bloomberg 1061, to San Francisco, Bloomberg 960, to the country, Sirius XM Channel 119, and around the globe, the Bloomberg Business App and BloombergRadio.com. This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
This week, Bloomberg Business Week's magazine, it's all about the year ahead issue, those things to keep on your radar in 2022. And Tim, that includes, of course, the semiconductor space. Big story last year. It's going to continue to be so this year. Innovation disruptors and just plain old competition playing its way out.
Yeah, the big question is who reigns supreme and how about the longtime, you know, kings of chip making or king of chip making? Does it remain king?
We have our own king of chip making.
We do. It's Ian King. He's U.S. semiconductor and networking reporter at Bloomberg News. Let's talk a little bit about Intel because the company is on the brink of losing its status as the world's largest chip maker. I thought that Pat Gelsinger came back to Intel to prevent this from happening.
Yeah, no, that's what he's been talking about. He's very, very focused on basically restoring Intel to its dominance. You remember when he left in 2009, Intel was at the peak of its powers. It was the largest chip maker by market value, the largest chip maker by revenue, the leader in terms of technology, the best plants, the best profit margins. It really was a leader, and now it's not. It's arguably going to lose the last of those titles, which is the one by revenue for 2021. And really everything that he's said since he took over last year is, look, I'm going to get Intel back. I'm going to put Intel back where it belongs.
So, hey, Ian, it's still going to be a dominant player, Intel that is, but what's the significance of, Intel and the history of what it has done in terms of chip making and just really Silicon Valley? How is that just kind of remarkable in terms of this shift?
Yeah, I mean, Intel basically taught the industry that, these are the economics that matter. Moore's Law that everybody quotes, Gordon Moore, the founder of Intel, it's about economics, it's about scale, it's about speed. Intel has always had the most capital to deploy. It's always moved faster. It's always made it difficult for the opposition to keep up. Now it's facing, and we talked about Samsung in the story, but also TSMC in Taiwan, companies that have as much access to capital, that are deploying as much capital, that are running just as fast as Intel, and they're enabling lots of other companies who they manufacture for to compete and to take market share away from Intel. Clearly, that's not good for Intel. As you say, it's still a huge company. It's $70 billion of revenue is not to be sniffed at. But that kind of lead, that ability to say, hey, here we are, you need to come chase me, and this is the pain that is involved in chasing me, that's gone away.
What do analysts say about Intel's ability or Pat Gelsinger's ability to pull this off?
Yeah, I mean, it's initially when he came, you know, back to Intel last February, said all the right things, said, look, this isn't good enough, this is not Intel, these, you know, mismanagement that's been going on while I've been away, I'm going to reverse that. Intel is back, you know, very much beating his fist on his chest and using a lot of the throwbacks to Intel's prior leadership in terms of the messaging. But then what became clear as Intel reported earnings averaged like a 7% decline on the day after every earnings was released, because those earnings were showing margins narrowing. Oh, and guess what? We're going to spend a lot of money to get us back. And so what's really going on is saying the right things, making the right decisions, arguably, but at the same time showing what the cost is and the amount of time it might take to get Intel back to leadership.
Hey, Ian, in a world where so much of the global economy is all about services, and certainly for the United States, we don't make a lot of stuff anymore, but the opportunity with a company like Intel where we actually make something, how important is that to the United States? And I think about, you know, government intervention or government assistance here in making sure that we're still, you know, making something in this global economy.
Yeah, I mean, if you are to view it from a nation-centric point of view, and Gelsinger is certainly one of those that does so, the chip industry is enormously important. It's a fundamental piece of technology that underpins everything. And the U.S., you know, that the ability to manufacture that is really centered in only Intel and a bit in Micron. Everybody else kind of doesn't do it anymore. It's done by Samsung. It's done by TSMC. Those are arguably the leaders right now. And what Gelsinger has argued and has, you know, gained some traction with politicians who are listening to him, saying, look, if we don't have this, we lose that ability. It's not something you can just get back. You know, it's based on knowledge. It's based on experience. And if that's going away, maybe it's gone for good. So he's really trying to do something about that.
That was Ian King, Bloomberg News U.S. semiconductor and networking reporter.
And we also heard this week that Taiwan Semiconductor will be spending at least $40 billion to address the ongoing chip shortage. That's above what Wall Street was forecasting. And that's the latest salvo from Intel's competition, a big competitor for Intel. You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week, coming up from posh driving in the great outdoors to wine sticker shock.
This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
The year ahead is not just about consumer trends, getting economic and monetary policy right, or figuring out which flying taxi to catch.
It's also about off-roading in luxury, non-alcoholic wine, and then dealing with, well, alcoholic wine sticker shock.
Got my attention, Tim Stenovic.
Yeah, well, that's the idea.
It's also about analyzing microorganisms in the food you eat. Yeah, it's a thing, everybody. Welcome to the world of wellness eating.
Carol, you caught up with the editor of Pursuits, Chris Rauser, who gave us a heads up on some luxe things to look forward to in 2022.
All right, so Chris, Ellen McCoy, your resident expert on all things wine, she talks about that we should get ready for some sticker shock this year. What's going on?
Yeah, Ellen has a great look ahead at a lot of the different trends of next year. And unfortunately for wine lovers, one of them is that prices are going to go up. Bad weather these past couple of years means that harvests were very small or even non-existent in some places. And so, you know, not only is inflation going on and some supply chain issues, people are paying more for bottles and corks and labels and even barrels, but also there's just like, there's not as many grapes. So you could see prices really go up like 10 to 20% more in 2022.
So I can use my NFTs or crypto to maybe pay for it all?
Yeah, you know, NFTs getting attached to a lot of different art or luxury items can kind of seem like a gimmick, but in the wine industry, people do actually think it's going to help with authenticity. And some big winemakers started selling wine bottles or wine experiences attached to NFTs this past year, and Ellen thinks you're going to see that more going forward because, you know, if someone comes to sell a bottle of wine at auction or directly through a dealer that they say is an original bottle they bought many years ago, from now on, people are going to have NFTs that can prove that.
It's wild, right? You just see the explosion. I've loved the coverage that you guys have done, especially in terms of fashion and what we're seeing. It's really interesting. Hey, one thing part of me says, no alcohol vino is coming. Why even bother? But I'm going to like open up my mind and embrace it. We're going to see more of this year?
Yes. And, you know, maybe the greatest symbol that no alcohol wine has arrived is that it appeared in the latest episode of And Just Like That, the Sex and the City spinoff. Miranda, the character, needs to give up drinking, and so they sit around and have a picnic and drink non-alcoholic wine. You know, we've been testing these non-alcohol or low-alcohol wines for a few years because the no-alcohol or low-alcohol movement is really catching on. And I never thought they were that terrible, but I don't have the taste buds that Ellen McCoy, our critic, does. And she's tried some of the new ones, and she says they're actually getting pretty good.
All right. Well, that's good to know. And I've been watching And Just Like That, so maybe I'll embrace it a little bit, too. Hey, golf. You do have something, too, in the section about the explosion of golf, specifically in Asia and Saudi Arabia and the Middle East. What's going on?
Yeah. So really what has happened is that there's been an explosion of money related to golf in the Middle East and in Asia. Saudi Arabia's public investment fund, PIF, is one of the world's largest sovereign wealth funds, and they have put $200 million into a venture between Saudi Golf and the Asian Tour to expand the Asian Tour. Basically, Saudi Arabia, as you know, has been investing billions of dollars into tourist infrastructure, getting people to view Saudi as a place to come and visit and hang out and stay in hotels and play golf. And so Saudi also wants to boost that whole golf culture in the region. And, you know, if you play in the PGA Tour in the U.S. and you're a big pro golfer, you can't accept an appearance fee, which means you can't get a fee just for showing up. But at the Asian Tour, you can. So Greg Norman, who's overseeing this investment into the Asian Tour from the Saudi end, says, you know what, golfers should be paid for showing up, actually. Like, they're the reason that people watch these games. And so, you know, they should actually get their due. And this is going to be appealing to pro golfers who may not have sort of really considered the tour as much in Asia.
Interesting to see that, and certainly something to consider. So let's talk a little bit about travel, because you guys cover it all the time in the section. Nikki Eckstein, traveling the world. She joins us now. And let's bring her in, because, Nikki, you have an interesting story about indigenous groups. They are finally getting a seat at tourism's table. It's kind of staggering that they really haven't had a voice in this. Tell us what's going on.
It's kind of hard to fathom that it's taken this long for the travel industry to kind of understand that this big piece was missing from the equation, given that travelers for so long have been seeking nothing other than authenticity. But here we are in 2022, and this is really the year that we're seeing destination marketing organizations, or what we call DMOs, really involve all of the diverse voices of their communities in how their destinations are represented.
No, Nikki, it's a really good story. And Chris, I think about when Nikki might have come to you and talked about this story. This was certainly not on my radar, but I do think about it when I travel around the country. And I think about when we, you know, are incorporating the Native American voice, it's often a very specific kind of museum type thing somewhere in the country. And it's nice to see that they're actually having, Chris, a bigger voice at our table when it comes to tourism overall. They're such a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, you just have to think about visits to like Yellowstone in Wyoming, or say you go to Mount Rushmore, and you're looking at, you're often sort of led to look at things from a white historical perspective, and you're really on Crow land, and the Lakota tribes were there too. And so now tours of these areas are incorporating, you know, Crow cultural stories. When you go to Little Bighorn Battlefield National Monument, they don't tell you about Custer's Last Stand. They tell you about the indigenous side of that story, or just think about going to the South and visiting plantations and the way those stories used to be told from the perspective of the people that lived in the plantation houses, and now how they're beginning to be told from the perspective of the enslaved people.
Nikki, what are you hearing? I mean, it's not just in the U.S., right? We're seeing it also over in Australia. And it sounds like there's a lot of tourism operators, too, that there's just the whole, you know, awareness of this has really taken off.
Absolutely. I think we're seeing it globally, in some places more than others. But Australia is a great example. The government there has a really large and substantial reparations program where they're really making Indigenous tourism, Aboriginal tourism, as we would call it in Australia, a cornerstone of what they want every itinerary to be about when people visit Australia. And the same is true in Canada, where First Nations people are becoming much more part of the tourism narrative, partially because the government is sponsoring new ways for First Nations travel business owners to actually digitize and market the products that exist so that they're more visible to consumers. So it's easier for consumers to find, book, and then feed into those tourism economies. At the end of the day, what really matters is not just that the stories are told, but that these people are involved in the travel economy and given jobs as guides and given the opportunity to really benefit from the massive travel industry. It's the third largest industry in the world.
I'm so glad you brought it to our attention. Nikki, thank you so much. Nikki Eckstein, who follows all things when it comes to travel around the globe. And this is just a really interesting part of this section. Nikki, thank you so much. All right, so finally, no pursuit section complete until we take a ride with our auto columnist, Hannah Elliott. And she's joining us now. We're adding her to the conversation. Hannah, you have an interesting story about I think the title on it is Velvet Glove Backcountry. I mean, this is about, you know, kind of going out to the backcountry in style, in luxury.
Yeah, you know, who knew? You do not need a hotel to live in luxury. In fact, you can just buy a big rig that has basically all of the comforts of a standard hotel and do it on your own. It's kind of great.
Overloading. I wonder if we'll be talking about this more. Tell us a little bit about the folks you talked to and what you saw and what their vehicles are like and who's all doing it.
Yeah, so it's really interesting. This is a young set of affluent, educated people. A lot are entrepreneurs. I talked to one man named Eli Kogan who is about to buy his second Earth Cruiser. These are, if you buy them new, they start at over $300,000. They're built on a Mitsubishi truck platform, but they're totally kitted out, like Chris said. And, you know, Eli is a really urbane, you know, clean-cut type of guy. He is not, you know, the sort of like Mad Max-style guy that you'd expect. And, you know, Matthew Stone is another guy I talked to. Sorry, Matthew Scott. He is the founder of Adventure Imports. He said that basically the industry has compressed 5 years' growth into about two. And, of course, due to COVID, people just want to be able to get away on their own terms, but do it in comfort.
So I'm thinking, Hannah, Rivian has got to be doing this.
Oh, you know it. They are capitalizing on the moment. Their timing could not have been better. Of course, we remember they had an incredible IPO in November. Mm-hmm. At one point, their value was over $100 billion. And their R1T truck is perfectly suited to appeal to this millennial-type buyer. It has a camp kitchen. It has this cool pass-through storage underneath the truck that will hold camp gear, but also, you know, like sound boom boxes, speakers. There's a speaker in the center console that comes with the truck. You know, it's Bluetooth equipped. It's pretty nice, I have to admit. And this is an expensive vehicle, too. I mean, with the first edition Rivian R1T with options, you can get close to $100,000 just on the truck.
Yeah, it sounds pretty cool. All right, guys, we got to run. Thank you so much. Our thanks
Thank you.
You bet. Our thanks to the editor of Pursuits, Chris Rouser, along with Nikki Eckstein, who joined us earlier on travel. And, of course, our auto columnist, Hannah Elliott. Thanks, you guys. Really appreciate it. And that wraps up the weekend edition of Bloomberg Business Week from Bloomberg Radio. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Tim Stenovek. Be sure to tune in to Bloomberg Business Week Monday through Friday. It starts at 2 p.m. Wall Street time on Bloomberg Radio.
You can also watch our daily broadcast on YouTube. Just search Bloomberg Global News.
And check out our Bloomberg Business Week podcast. You can find it at Bloomberg.com, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Bloomberg Business Week is available on newsstands now at Bloomberg.com and on the Bloomberg Terminal.
And you can also see me on Bloomberg Quick Take. It's available at Bloomberg.com/QT and streaming platforms like Roku, Apple TV, Samsung TV, and more. Have a great weekend.
Stay safe, everyone. This is Bloomberg.